Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our guest, I'd like to do just a couple of housekeeping points. First of all, everybody please turn off your cell phones now, or at least put them on silent. You shouldn't be embarrassed if everybody checks their mobiles now to put it on mute, but if it goes off later, we will embarrass you. So please do turn them off now. Second of all, I'd like to tell you just briefly on our next couple of events. On Thursday, we have the Deputy Prime Minister of New Zealand speaking, the Honorable Bill English. And next Tuesday, we have the now Chief Executive, as a result of his promotion last week, of Li & Fung, Bruce Rockowitz. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest for today. Martin Brudermüller is the Vice Chairman of BASF, been with the company 23 years, started his first 5 years in the lab, so if you have any really obscure chemistry questions, I imagine he can field those as well. More recently, however, his move to Hong Kong is another sign of how big European companies and big Western companies in general are taking Asia more seriously. He's the only Vice Chairman for BASF and has now been transferred here. With that, I'd give you him. Thank you.
Yeah, so ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining. It's a good opportunity. I'm very happy to be here in the Foreign Correspondents Club to talk about a very important topic, I think. Can Asia improve energy efficiency? Maybe to start off, to just familiarize you with one chart, what is BASF? And I think BASF is the largest chemical company in the world, and by serving basically all the major manufacturing industries, I think we have a good insight also in the topic here, because we provide raw materials to basically all the downstream stuff we are consuming in our modern civilization, and we have a lot of contact to customers and work on a lot of topics, as you will see later. It's the, as I said, the world's largest company by sales. We have 63.9 billion sales in 2010, and we employ roughly 100,000 people worldwide and 16,000 people here in Asia. Well, why do we need to talk about energy efficiency? I think there's a lot going around about this topic. In my eyes, the most credible institute defining a little bit what's going on is the IPCC. I think they have done many studies and taken together positions that are also widely accepted in the scientific community today. The conclusion is that global warming or climate disruption can be attributed to greenhouse gas emissions caused by humans and its civilization, and that this creates certain risks for people on Earth, including certainly all the businesses. I think it is very tough to really understand all what's going in, all the processes and mechanisms. But nevertheless, I think it is clear we have to address this topic. And I think it is only possible by decisive action to mitigate this situation. The question is, however, how? We believe that it needs and requires joint goals and strategies which makes sense both financially, but also for the environment. And we also believe there should be a fair system to share burdens that will inevitably have to create. I think if we look into this topic, energy production is certainly the most important source of greenhouse gases today. And I think we not so easily simply can reduce energy production. I think this is particularly true for Asia, because if we look into the main megatrends we face in the future, which is, on one hand, an increasing population. We expect about 9.3 billion people on Earth in 2050, and about 5 billion of the people live in Asia. But it's also about urbanization. Urbanization will proceed with about 67% in 2025, and here also 25% of the cities with more than 500,000 of people will be located in China. It is also about mobility. People want to have cars. We most probably face about 1.2 billion cars in 2020, with more than 50% of those cars will be on Asian roads. All this certainly will be associated with higher demand of energy. There are a lot of predictions. One, I think, rational or good prediction is that about 50% more primary energy will be needed in 2035 compared to 2007. And India and China alone will have about one third of this energy demand. So in Asia, energy demand is growing rapidly. According to these numbers, with about 4.2% per year, and this compares to about 2% in the OECD countries. So it's clear it needs to manage these carbon emissions with multiple solutions, and it's, I think, evident and not disputed that energy efficiency is a real crucial part of that. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, estimates that up to half of required improvements must come from energy efficiency in order to tackle that in the right way for mankind. So, however, the news is not bad at all, because energy efficiency is a proven contributor already today. And the International Energy Agency has determined that without energy efficiency, final energy use today would most probably be 63% higher in the OECD countries. So there is a good lever for this. If you look into this and study a little bit historical data, I think one gets good evidence where are the big levers to get most bang for the buck. And I think best was this done by a study, was McKinsey in 2007, which have basically plotted this graph, which shows you that big levers are basically almost coming for free, because they have so-called negative investment. It is basically where money on one hand, but also potentials for energy efficiency are on the road. And this is definitely building. Insulation, you will see later that a huge part of primary energy consumption today is associated with buildings. And the other part and the other thing is, it's not astonishing, is all what is connected with mobility. It's the fuel efficiency in today's transportation. And these two topics I would like to highlight in the further presentation and also show a little bit what can be done. Let me address building insulation first. It's amazing, but buildings currently consume about 35% of the world energy around the globe. And making them with this certainly one of the most obvious targets for energy efficiency. Fortunately, there are already many solutions that can address this need. And I'm not talking now about speculative technologies coming in the future like OLED photovoltaics and all this, but I talk about very tangible technologies that exist today. And what is nice, certainly for a BASF, many of these solutions lastly stem from the world of chemistry. A lot of people talk about insulation, and this is absolutely crucial, but it is not only limited to walls or traditional systems. We also have to look, or better have to look instead, in the overall heat and energy management of buildings, so energy-efficient materials to be employed in buildings. And this includes certainly rigid wall insulation panels, spray foams for wall insulation, but also heating reflecting treatments of floors and more. It also includes later innovations coming from the chemical industry, like infrared reflecting pigments that will allow walls and roofs to reflect the sun's heat even if they are colored in black. These technologies have a great deal of untapped potential in Asia. It's actually surprising how less they are applied across the region. Asia has many extreme climate conditions, both hot and cold, from the cold in the north to the west of China, but also to the tropical conditions in Malaysia, India, and Indonesia. And whether it is for maximizing or minimizing air condition or minimizing heating, the technologies I mentioned a moment ago can be applied here. For example, we recently completed a study in Singapore and India that our latest insulation material, Neopor, works both for conserving energy in hot climates and in cold climates. Yet at that moment, energy consumption per square meter is 2 to 3 times higher in China than in the EU. So a huge lever to improve. I mean, also here in Hong Kong, just to give you an example, about buildings consume about 90% of the energy used in Hong Kong, and they account about for 67% of carbon emissions in Hong Kong. But I also mentioned that there is more to energy-efficient housing than insulation materials alone. There are innovative pigments, for example, today, that are not only decorative, but they also serve environmental purposes, for example, by cutting the solar heat built up by half, and they need for energy-intensive air condition is significantly reduced. Coatings that can reflect solar are basically not at all employed in buildings. There's one other lever which people are not aware of. About 5% of global CO2 emissions come from cement production. So they are certainly associated very much with areas where there is a high need for residential and infrastructure, which is again Asia and China. So about 5.2% growth in cement production. You can also apply here very smartly chemistry by so-called concrete admixtures that allow not only better and more modern structures, which are very much going hand in hand with architectural ideas and needs, but really to improve significantly CO2 emissions. Just to give you an idea, admixtures employed globally so far are standing for about 20 million tons of CO2 reductions on a global scale, but not much employed so far in China, for example. Let me move over to vehicles. Most importantly here, the substitution of metal parts by plastics leads to significant weight reduction, in average about 50% weight reduction. And you can see that from that picture that many parts of the cars can now be replaced by advanced and extremely durable engineering plastics that would have been impossible a few years ago. And this development is not yet at an end. Everything from the engine mount to a bumper stiffer, an oil pan, or even a seat frame today can be made out of plastics. And this in turn has a significant impact on carbon reductions because every 100 kilo of weight reduction in a car reduces fuel consumption by about half a liter per 100 kilometer, which is an equivalent to roughly 1 kilo CO2 per 100 kilometer. Indeed, there are much more than only saving weight, where chemical industry can contribute a lot. It is also by simply producing cars more more energy efficient. Just to give you one example, you might not know that painting a car is one of the most energy intensive pieces of producing a car because you have high heat for a relatively long time. A body has to grow this coloring street, and there are new coatings now that are simply hardening with UV light. So you have only a 2-3 minutes impact on UV light, and you save a lot of this very energy intensive, high temperature burning process of coating a car. Last not least, one other big lever is we have to treat the fuel. If you take fuel additives, you can reduce fuel consumptions in cars by about 2% in average. And also this widely not employed at all in Asia. If we, for example, look into the plastics usage in cars, we come a long road here in Europe. We had about 6% of the weight of a car in Europe in average in 97, 6%. This increased to about 15% currently. And we expect that, particularly also stimulated by electromobility, we'll at least have 25% in the future. If we compare that development and that standard today with China, an average car produced in China has just a content of about 10% of plastics, and the other 90% being metal, and also very cheap plastic materials employed, not much the high-performance engineering plastic. So upgrading the production in China for cars is a huge lever to save energy and to reduce carbon emissions. So there are many goals in major Asian countries. How can they be achieved? I have listed here four targets that have been addressed by governments in four major Asian economies. They mostly refer to a carbon usage per ton of product or per ton of GDP, whatever. We have to be aware this is a specific reduction on produced goods and on GDP. But I just remind you, in absolute terms, energy need is still increasing. So in China, for example, they want to reduce the carbon intensity by 40 to 45% up to 2020. Maybe for all of us too slow, but I think rightly addressed in the 12th five-year plan. I think very good and clear target to go for more sustainability and go for better environmental footprint. Also, India has target to reduce carbon intensity to by basically 25% until 2020. As well, it is in Korea, but also in an already relatively energy-efficient country like Japan, where further improvements are possible. Let me come to three recommendations, what I think could be really major levers in Asia to now really short-term immediately do something on energy efficiency and exploit the potential. Building energy efficiency is challenged by the fact, and we all know this here also in Hong Kong, that one who pays is not necessarily the one who benefits. And this is one of the major obstacles why it is not really happening. This can be confirmed here in Hong Kong, I think, because if you ask your landlord to do more on insulation to reduce your air conditioned costs, usually not much is happening, and the drive and the spirit to really go for an investment where they don't have a payback is not very high. This, I think, is in many countries like this. It's also in China, where a developer has a completely different interest than the government or the tenant. So for that reason, I think what needs to be done is so-called PPP model. That's the public-private partnership. I think a lot can be achieved here. On one hand, this helps not only to finance initial projects, but on the other hand, it also provides a proof of concept by putting the technologies that should be used in the right climate and in the right environment and also to the right income environment. And it can be put into context of smart regulation. And I think with this, with so-called lighthouse projects, where we also work on with several bodies in China, I think this is the right way to go forward. We at BASF, we have currently implemented several of these projects in China. There is, for example, a small retrofit project in the Bohai machinery, where we have made a significant difference in energy consumption by assuming and applying some of those technologies I have just mentioned in a 2,800 square meter area. This was basically a starting point. We have then increased this initiative to another one, which is imposing a building area of 82,000 square meters, where we were able to make these buildings not only more energy efficient, but I think you see also from the pictures, they also look much nicer for the people to actually live in this environment. The biggest project we have in the moment running is where we currently work with PetroChina in a project to renovate 1.2 million apartments across China to insulate them and with them reduce also the energy consumption. And this is basically the area in northern China. This is basically a living area of 50 million square meters where we apply all these technologies. These projects are under implementation, but we have proven that this works in several demo projects. One of them is in Shanghai, in the Hoku district, where we really could show between before and after to reduce energy consumption in buildings by more than 60%. My second recommendation is a little bit related to industry policy. It is about intellectual industry clustering, because so far we have mostly talking about the consumer level only, but it is certainly also that energy efficiency in the industry has to be addressed and is a crucial factor. And by clustering energy-intensive industries, like, for example, in the chemical industry, you can really tremendously save energy. And this concept of highly energy efficient and massively integrated production has still strong potential in Asia, because many countries have not yet industry policies to really bundle industries and with this lift these potentials. With such a system as we, for example, apply it in our internal production to really cluster and bring all together the chemical industry, you can, for example, use the waste product from one production and use it as a raw material for the other plant. And the same is also for heat. You have sometimes heat off heat or waste heat from one plant, which you can apply in the next plant, where if it would be isolated, you have to have energy generations. And I think the best proof point that really works, if we count together all these integrated productions, which we not only have in Ludwigshafen in Germany and in Antwerp in Belgium, but we also imported this into Asia. We have a huge site in Nanjing, which we are continuously expanding, and one in Kuantan together with local partners. If we count all this production together, then we have been able over the recent years since 1990 to increase our production volumes by 86%. And in the same moment, we have reduced the greenhouse gas emissions by 21%. And this is all a question of efficiency and energy efficiency. And if you count this per ton, then this is basically a 61% reduction of energy intensity in the product. And I think this shows how big this potential is. And it can be done not only by one company, a big one like BASF. It can be also done across companies, bringing companies together from suppliers, raw material producers, and then downstream producers, and that with this build up value chains and cluster them. And I think this is a real huge opportunity for Asia, throughout Asia, to improve with energy efficiency. And that brings me to my third and last recommendation, which brings this all in a little bit a bigger picture. Because we can make as many recommendations as we want, at the very end it's the consumer who ultimately has the power to create change with the wallets. Problem is that the customers usually do not have the whole picture about the carbon footprint of the products when they make their purchasing decision. And we believe that carbon management must be based on an evaluation of products basically from a life cycle perspective, from a cradle to grave analysis. And that must imply what kind of raw materials are used, how it is produced, where the materials are sourced, when is the product put in use, does it consume energy or does it help to save energy? How is the end of life? Is it landfill or can it be recycled or can it be used for energy production? So I think all this has to come together, and with this giving a kind of an overall life cycle carbon footprint. And I think if we make this transparent to consumers, then consumers have also a huge argument and rationale to help to address energy efficiency, because I think everyone has the interest to contribute in a way that you buy a product which has a better environmental footprint. So we look forward to these mechanisms because it is partly market-driven and regulatory, certainly, and it has to include modern technology benchmarking. But I think with this tool, we can better reflect the true carbon impact of a product on the market and with the consumer. So with this, in summary, question, can Asia improve energy efficiency? I would clearly say yes, it can. We are very optimistic. Also, the energy demand is booming in Asia Pacific, and the growth of commerce does not necessarily have to mean however, grows in carbon. We believe Asia can improve energy efficiency and that many of the solutions at the end will somehow come or be stimulated by the chemical industry. I thank you very much for your attention and I invite you for questions. Thank you very much.
Throw open the floor to questions. Please identify yourself and your organization. Thank you. Right up here, Tom. Get the microphone up here, please.
Thank you very much. I'm Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. You make great claims for the potential of energy efficiency or increased energy efficiency to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I assume you're aware of the Jevons paradox, which states that the more you increase energy efficiency, the more energy you use. Example would be jet engines have become very much more efficient over the last 40 years or so. We don't use less jet fuel now. We use a great deal more because the cost of air travel has been reduced and air travel has exploded. So increasing energy efficiency means more, not less, energy use. How would you respond to that?
Well, this is a question you sometimes get on this. I think, first of all, by the fact that we can save energy, which I should not abandon by saying if we save the energy, we use it more for others. I think it has to go, and I think I mentioned this in some of the examples, it has to go hand in hand with regulation and also fair energy pricing. I think one major point is, if you, for example, look on building insulation, and we studied this very much in detail in a project in Chongqing, where we are also a bigger investor. If you look at the low energy costs you have in China, and you take the top 1 million households in Chongqing, and you say, I would reduce their air condition cost by 50%, you basically end up by almost at only €200 of savings for them. With €200, you hardly can invest in building insulation, because it simply does not pay off. For that reason, I think with energy pricing, if energy pricing is market-driven, certainly also the lever for saving for households is getting stronger. And with this, you have an investment story and you have a financial return. So I think in that respect, we have to put this both hand in hand, technological innovation, regulation, but also the right energy pricing. And I think with this, you can address that. I think over time, you'd reduce really the footprint over time. And this certainly, and that's why I mentioned the consumer, I think if we really want to reduce the carbon footprint long term, we have to have behavioral changes of consumers. But it cannot be the driver that we say we have innovation in technology and we just don't do it because then we consume more energy. I mean, this cannot be, the logic.
Next. Okay, two questions. First up here and then next over there.
Thank you for your presentation. My name's Robert Todd at HSBC. You cited the five-year plan in China and a number of interesting projects. I'll be interested to hear your views about the role of homegrown technologies emerging from China and the role that they have to play as part of this reduction in carbon intensity.
Well, I mean, certainly I think it's very evident if you read through the 12th five-year plan that China wants to move away from the basically the working bench of the world to a more innovation-driven society. I think also partly the carbon footprint, if you are really honest, China partly produced the ugly part our civilization needs in other countries. And I think they want to get rid of this. And with this, I think the lever is clearly innovation and technology. They have recognized that this cannot be all imported. This is also not their interest, but increasingly develop it on their own, which I think is the right way to go. I have to say, we as an innovative company, we are not afraid of this development because for us it opens by far more opportunities than risk. Because we invest about €1.5 billion in R&D, and we would like to work with our customers, innovative customers, to drive jointly technological development forward. And this is also the development we can see, which is positive for us, for our business development in China, that more and more of our customers, they move away from just asking a commodity chemical, but more and more will work with us on innovative solutions. And this is also why we are investing heavily in R&D in China. We currently build an R&D center in Shanghai with more than 500 people to respond, to be close to the customers, to work with those. So I think overall, for innovative technology-driven companies, I think this development in China is by far more an opportunity than a threat. And I think for a healthy company, you cannot be against competition. That sometimes keeps you also running. And if we compete with technology everywhere in the world, why not with Chinese?
Over here, please.
Hi, Gavin Edwards with Greenpeace International. I think your observation on apartment buildings and the dilemma of the property owner versus the tenant really encapsulates well why, and in certain cases, particularly on efficiency, you need regulation. You need regulation to step in. But time and again, we find that when legislation on energy efficiency or on an energy package is being put together, we find, for example, with the German car industry 3 years ago, basically watering down that legislation in Europe because it would benefit the French and Italian car manufacturers and not the German manufacturers. In Hong Kong last year, we had a big debate over an energy future for Hong Kong that was very, very light on energy efficiency. In part, I think, because the LegCo didn't want to get into too much of a fight with developers. So I guess my question to you and to BASF is, could you be a counterbalance to these other industries that potentially stand to lose from strong energy efficiency regulation? And how vociferous are you in pushing for stronger regulation that could benefit innovative industries like yourself?
Yeah, I mean, regulation is always a two-sided sword. And I mean, if it is going to strangulize an industry by being so fast compared to the world standards, you can distort competitiveness. And on the other hand, I think we are aware, and it's right that certain regulation has to trigger certain also developments in society. I think it is very much the secret of keeping this in balance. I think it is clear. It also in Europe it drove many things in the right direction by putting also regulation in there. But you have then to define, first of all, the pace. And the second is you have also to involve and to listen to all stakeholders. And I think this is also what we try to do in China now. And let me come again to the building part here. If you certainly talk with them, we have technology in Germany. And for example, BASF has developed a housing concept where you can reduce average 25 liters of oil per square meter and year in energy you need to for the heat management in Europe. We can reduce this to 1 liter or to 3 liter, and if you take solar panels, even to zero. It's only a question of investment. It's certainly such heavy investment that you hardly have any return on this. So it doesn't make sense to bring this into the regulation and say to the Chinese, you know, go for the best technology available in the world and you apply this in the apartments in Chongqing. It will not fly. So you have to discuss with them what is a reasonable standard we can do which fits to the income circumstances. What do you have to do to really force the developers in really applying it? Because simply the developers in China, they have no interest at all to increase their investment costs because they hardly can get more on the market. They want to maximize their benefit. So I think what is important is that is really a constructive dialogue, the right pace in the right environment with all the stakeholders on board. And I think if we do this, then I think we have the right levers. And this applies certainly also for Europe, where maybe to finish my statement with this, we have now some of the discussions in Europe that are not in balance. I mean, if you impose carbon 2 taxes and now the energy discussion in Germany particular, in shutting down nuclear, then you have to ensure that also a very innovative industry stays still competitive. We can discuss about all this, but it has to be in the right balance and in the right speed also to do this transformation process. Did this answer your question? Or you have...
Back here, please.
Hello there. My name is Kian Ng from Richard Butler. I'm very curious about two things. I like very much your cradle-to-grave concept on the carbon footprint, and also previously when you talked about highly engineered plastic replacement parts for cars. I'm interested to hear your comments on the total carbon equation, total carbon use. Say, I mean, for example, currently if you have steel parts that require 2 units of energy to produce, but then, you know, the new parts actually require more carbon to produce. I mean, does that really, I mean, how does that add in a total equation sense?
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what I said. If you go to car companies today, we basically look on all this picture. It is not only the part for the car ladle that is obviously has a weight that is 50% less, but we also look into it, what does it take to produce it? And I think even more important, what do you do with the car if it has finished its life? You can dismantle the plastics part. Most of the time, because you have so many different plastics, the recycling doesn't make much sense because you spend so much in selecting it that the best thing is you use it thermally, because a plastics material still has about 95% of the same energy than oil has. So you simply don't burn oil directly, but you take the oil through the plastic materials. It has a lifetime, and then you burn the plastics to make energy out of it. So you had basically two lifetimes of the oil, on one hand producing the energy, and on the other hand, the car piece. So I can only say this industry, because you referred on car industry, which is a quite sophisticated one, they absolutely claim this kind of analysis from us today, because they want to have also this transparent, increasingly transparent for the consumer. And what is really nice from what we have achieved so far in also going into parts where traditional car engineers that are usually all metal-oriented, because they study at university welding and metal and not plastic materials, it's sometimes very hard to convince them that, for example, a part that is heavily exposed to temperature in an engine, for example, that you can do this in a lifetime for a car out of plastics. We have, for example, now the first car companies that ask ourselves, can you make the frame of a car no longer out of steel, but maybe out of plastics? So without this transparency, we simply could not move forward. And in this respect, we stimulate each other both. It's a kind of a push and a pull. We show them increasingly what chemistry can do, and they get creative by asking, I would have a problem, can you translate into chemistry? So it's a very fruitful process going forward. And we imply this more and more also to the Chinese producers to really help them to keep track with European producers and to bring more plastics into cars.
Edith, here, please.
Edith Terry. One of the big problems facing Hong Kong and many other high-density cities is landfill. Hong Kong is running out of landfill. I wondered if you're involved with the waste-to-energy and mining waste end of the equation, and if you could sketch some of the newer technologies and developments that address landfill issues, waste issues.
Actually, I'm not so close to this. Where we are involved is certainly in the mining industry, also here with chemicals to help to get the minerals out of the soil. Because what is a trend globally with all the BHP billitons and the Rio Tintos and you name them, is that they basically, the natural resources they find today have less and less content of minerals. That means you have to move more and more tons, you have to grind those materials with a huge amount of energy employed, and then somehow to extract these minerals. And this is also only possible with chemistry to increase efficiency with this. But I'm not so much honestly involved then is what is with the waste of the mining industry, how you can use this maybe for landfill or whatever. I cannot help you very much on that, sorry.
One last question over here, please.
Hi, Gavin Burring from Dragonomics.
This may be a bit out of your field, but do you have any comments on urban planning generally in China? Because I think the issue for buildings there is not just about the individual buildings and the technology that can be applied there, but the fact that these buildings are all part of huge new towns that are being built on a very massive scale. So I was just wondering if you had any general comments on urban planning from a sort of macro point of view and improvements.
Well, I mean, we are working with some of the communities, distinct cities, and try to be involved there with our construction chemicals and working on those concepts which I mentioned earlier, public and private-public partnerships. I'm not so much an expert now in urbanization concepts. However, with some of those authorities you talk to, I have to say they increasingly imply good ideas in order to how to design future cities, in order to make them more tangible with less individual traffic, more public transportation system. I think this is going in the right direction. However, I mean, you cannot change a lot of those cities overnight because they are having a certain design and already massive, huge agglomerations. The main concern really is that, and what you mentioned, the quality of most of the housing in China is so lousy that it looks nice for a few years and then it goes down very fast. And partly the materials applied are the wrong ones. It starts with simple questions that if you discuss with one of those authorities and city planning authorities, and we say, okay, you could apply this and this insulation system, they ask a simple question and said, do you have a method how I can prove that the developer really employed it? So it's a very, very interesting, or it gives you a hint how basic sometimes these problems are. Even if you do regulation, you have to prove that the developer is really applying to the standards. So I think this is really a huge problem in this area. I have also to say the news I hear that some of the infrastructure projects that are very fastly executed are partly also not using the right materials, which could imply that, let's say, usage might be limited in terms of how long you can use them. You might have to replace them earlier as foreseen, and partly maybe also huge cost for repair of wrong materials that have been used. So quality assurance, assistance, consultancy in using the right materials is a crucial element, I think, for China for infrastructure, urban structures.
One more quick question.
Yeah, we only have a minute left, so let me be very quick. There's been a large effort in many industries to create certifications that are voluntary. So, for instance, certain coffee companies say coffee comes from something and it's more ethical than others. And you see these quality. Now, you've made a huge statement that your stuff is better and a lot of the other stuff in the market is crap. Have you ever thought of doing something that gives kind of a public branding for housing projects, for instance, or other, you know, infrastructure projects that use your environmentally more conscientious standards or your higher quality standards that actually allow people to see? Because after all, if a building developer actually developed a site and there was something that they could put on their marketing thing that says this is a much more efficient building, then it would become much more cost efficient for the people who bought the stuff if they were aware. And you don't necessarily have to have government, as someone was suggesting, to have that happen.
No, I mean, we don't create the own labels for our products and say ours are good and the rest is crap. What we do is we provide solutions for energy efficiency, and then it's with the customer industry and the customer to really apply it and make it an advantage in terms of environmental footprint, but also certainly economical for them. There is a problem that there is a lot of greenwashing and green labeling, that everyone, it's now fashionable to put some green label on it. And indeed, and that's what I said with the method of the life cycle analysis, the transparency for the consumer is basically not there.
I know, so the question is, why can't you do anything to solve it? But I think we're out of time, and unless you want to
address
that.
I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah.
Pardon?
If you'd like to address it, you get the last word. Tom doesn't, much though he might prefer it.
I mean, the question is, do you want to address that? Can you address it? If you can't address it, that's fine.
I think we cannot address it alone. We can address it with institutions together to have standards, because I think if everyone defines his own standard, then you have hundreds of those labels where the consumer cannot determine. So I think for that reason, you have to work together with authorities and regulation to make this transparent, measurable, and with this then also convincing for the consumer at the end.
Thank
you. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
We always like to give our guests something to remember the club by. I think this might have been made by some out of materials from your previous job as president of Functional Polymers.
But, okay.
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. See some of you probably on Thursday or Tuesday. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Is there one more question?